Before we dive into today's episode, I wanted to share a free resource just for you. It's called 5 Ways to Connect with God. In our busy world, it's easy to feel spiritually dry, but this short guide introduces 5 timeless practices like one-phrase prayers, cultivating thankfulness, and meditating slowly on scripture. They can refresh your soul and draw you closer to God. You can download your free copy today at premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. Now, let's get into today's podcast.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim White and I'm joined by my dad, John White. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
And today we're going to rattle through a question and a news story in one of our kind of shorter Q&A episodes. The news story is this. This is the headline from BBC News from just a few weeks ago. Scientists make embryos from human skin DNA for the first time. US scientists have for the first time made early stage human embryos by manipulating DNA taken from people's skin cells and then fertilizing it with sperm. They say the technique could overcome infertility due to old age or disease and could use almost any cell in the body as the starting point for life. It could even allow same-sex couples to have a genetically related child. We're going to talk through what exactly the science is first, I think, before we then get into the kind of ethics of it and what on earth we should think about this as Christians. So take it away, Dad. What on earth are we talking about here?
Yeah, so just sort of a bit of background before we wade into the details. So one of the fascinating discoveries of the Human Genome Project, when, you know, people have been going around the world collecting DNA from human beings across the planet, but also from lots of other species. And what turns out, number one, is that every human being has very, very closely similar DNA, and it appears that we have common male and female ancestors that are not that far away, 50,000 to 100,000 years maybe ago. And so, as I quite often say, every human being is a distant relative. Every time you meet someone, another human being, you're meeting a relative. And therefore, human ethics is really family ethics. It's about how we treat one another as as distant relatives. But also, it turns out that we're genetically very closely related to other organisms. And it turns out that, roughly speaking, your average mouse is 95% has the same DNA as human beings. I think it's
somewhat
true to say
alarming,
fruit,
isn't it?
It is. That fruit flies have 70%, and it's said a banana has 50%. You know, and I remember somebody genetically saying that I remind myself that of my colleagues that 50% of them come from banana, and sometimes the resemblance is very obvious. But why this is important is it turns out, therefore, that mice are extremely useful because they are so similar to us, and therefore, if you can make things work in mice, the chances are that you can make something work in human beings as well. When it comes to particularly things involving genes, programming and reprogramming. And what was worked out first in mice and then applied in humans is that it's possible to reprogram cells in lots of different ways to persuade one type of cells to turn into other types of cells. And one of the astonishing discoveries was it was possible to reprogram skin cells to become a much more basic kind of cell type, which was able to create other kinds of cells. And these kind of stem cells are used now in different kinds of therapy. But there's always been a dream of trying to unpick the process of reproduction itself, with the idea being, could we create artificial sperm and could we create artificial eggs? And part of the fascination is just the very real reality of human infertility and the struggles which go on with a reproductive technology, with infertile, with people who are attempting to create babies by in vitro fertilization. But it's also true to say that the basic science is absolutely of fundamental fascination. And part of the reason why scientists are drawn to this area is because of what it could teach us about the very fundamentals of the way that our cells work. And undoubtedly, there are Nobel Prizes to be won with people working in this area. But I think it's what I've sometimes called in the past the Lego kit view of humanity, because the wonderful thing about a Lego kit, certainly the original versions as they once were, is that they don't have any underlying order or structure. You simply get a whole load of bricks of different shapes and sizes and colors, and you can do with them whatever you like. And the whole point about them is they all fit together. And the same is true fundamentally of cells. You know, this Lego kit views cells as basically they all fit together and we can try something else. And look, I can just take that yellow bit with that funny bit and I've added that to a blue bit. And would you believe it? Look what it does now. And this kind of, the only limits are in your creativity. You know, what might we do? And so here, what was being reported is a highly creative form of experiment. Scientists worked out some years ago that it was possible to take the nucleus out of an egg cell and put in other DNA material. And you could then, by doing various maneuvers, you could persuade this new creation, this hybrid version, that it was in fact an egg cell again. And that was the technology behind the creation of Dolly the sheep. Something similar has been used in human beings, not to create clones as in Dolly the sheep, but as a treatment for people with a rare condition called mitochondrial diseases, which is passed on by the mitochondrial DNA, which is in the egg, rather than the nuclear DNA, which is in the center. So there's a lot of science here I'm conscious of. Are you with me so far, Tim? Or do you,
yes,
do
I
need to go
I think
back?
So. So we're talking about how cells that originally do one thing, they might be a skin cell, it might be something else. Scientists have figured out in recent times how to force a cell to become something else, or at least to take bits out of it. And so you can potentially have a skin cell, and in this case, in a human egg cell, and you can take the nucleus, which kind of the center of the cell that houses the genetic code, out of an egg cell, put a different nucleus inside it, and make it do things that it wasn't originally able or intending to do. Is that right?
That's right. And so, to cut to the chase, what was reported just a few weeks ago in a very major journal, Nature Communications, was a report which is open access. So we'll make the link so that anybody who's interested can see it. Which comes from a research group who've basically taken a complex set of experiments with the goal being, would it be possible to persuade a human egg to have its nucleus changed and then persuade it to behave from a nucleus from another egg, which is what has happened previously, but with the nucleus, the DNA material coming from a skin cell. Could we take the DNA, the genetic material from a skin cell, stick it into a human egg, which has had its own DNA removed, its nucleus removed, and then max it up with a sperm, help it meet sperm, and then fertilize it. And effectively, what this team claimed is that they were able to achieve that. It was an extraordinary amount of work was involved. And interestingly, the human egg cells were obtained, a large number, I think it was 80.
82 functional eggs were made, yeah.
And these came from human volunteers. So these would be young women who would be recruited, probably by an advert. You know, would you be prepared to donate your eggs for scientific research? And they would be given informed consent, and then they would agree to undergo a procedure whereby they were given hormones to generate hyperovulation, so to generate many multiples of eggs, maybe 20 eggs, as much, 10 to 20 eggs, in a simple menstrual cycle. They then undergo laparoscopy, a surgical procedure, to, quote, harvest the eggs. And then,
so this is the same thing that happens at the start of traditional IVF.
It is. And it's a very major,
in one sense.
It is commonplace, but it's a very major thing to undergo purely for scientific research, and actually carries some risks to the mother, to the woman who's undergoing the hyperovulation and so on. Small, but definite risks. So that in itself raises interesting questions about, you know, the ethics and is this appropriate and all the rest. But they then, of those 82, they managed to have a small number where they effectively managed to get successful creation of an embryo, a human embryo, and they managed to have some divisions of the human embryo, and then they were destroyed.
One of the challenges, I understand, is that when you take the skin cell nucleus that has its genetic DNA inside and you put that into the donated egg, the skin cell, because it comes from a fully grown human being, has all a full set of chromosomes, of the 23 pairs of chromosomes that humans have, whereas in traditional God designed reproduction, the eggs only have half and the sperm have the other half, and it's when they combine and form an embryo that you get the full set of DNA. And so what the scientists had to do is figure out a way of taking this skin cell with the DNA, putting it into the egg, and then getting the egg to jettison half the chromosomes so that it was then ready when it was combined with the sperm to kind of to go back up to full complement.
That's right. So it's an extraordinarily complex process. What you're trying to mimic is a process which happens every time a human egg is developed. It splits into half of the DNA component, ready to receive the rest of the DNA from the sperm. And so this is certainly not ready for human use. There are all sorts of issues that need to be addressed and so on. But theoretically, let's suppose, you know, 10 years down the line and this has now been perfected, what would this mean? Well, it would mean, suppose, for example, I am a man with another male, I mean, in a gay relationship. We're desperate to have a child that reflects our uniqueness of our relationship. And what we do is we pay for a donor egg to be provided. That donor egg has its DNA from the donor removed, from the woman who donated it. My DNA is then placed into that donor egg, so it now becomes effectively as though I had created an egg, and then it's fertilized with the sperm of my partner, and then lo and behold, we have a child or children who reflect our unique child as a combination of my DNA and my partner's DNA.
So mimicking the process that happens in heterosexual conception, which is that every child produced obviously by an opposite sex couple is a combination of half the DNA comes from father and half comes from mother. And this would, for the first time, allow same-sex couples to claim that their child is genetically related to both parents, not just the dad who donated the sperm.
Yes, and to be fair, it would also apply to infertile heterosexual couples. So suppose I'm an older woman, I'm desperate to have a child of my own genetic inheritance, I can't produce eggs myself, but I could have donor eggs, and instead of accepting the DNA from the donor, I have my own DNA put in those donor eggs. And so we now have a child who has my DNA and my partner's DNA. So I'm actually just reproducing what would happen normally, but of course I'm an older woman, and there's no limit to the age. I could be 50s, 60s, 70s if I so wished.
I suppose one way to think of it is a kind of super high-tech extension of surrogacy. Because in as we've discussed in previous episodes, there's, you know, a lot of modern surrogacy involves IVF, so that the embryo implanted into the surrogate mother's womb is genetically related to the intending parents, whatever language you want to use, and the mother is effectively donating her young, healthy womb to incubate that child. And in this version, what we've done is we've taken a young, healthy ovum cell from a donor and then inserted the genetic material from the intended parents and then used that to kind of grow the child from that. So from one sense, it's kind of a very high-tech molecular extension of surrogacy.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think it is interesting, isn't it, that because this fundamental mechanistic Lego kit view of reproduction, and in some ways surrogacy has already created that Lego kit.
Yeah.
You know, once intellectually I've accepted the fact that there is no direct connection between the relationship that I'm in with my spouse and the baby that we produce, then I think all bets are off. And certainly what so often happens is that intellectually we're open to something and then the technologists come along and say, well, actually, you know, we've got the technology. We can make it happen. We can make your dreams come true, but there's always going to be a price to pay. But if you really want to, we can make your dreams come true.
And it feels in some ways another example of what a lot of kind of cutting edge medical research kind of does, which is to say we are dissatisfied with the limitations or the tracks in which human biology works, and we would like to adjust things. You know, so to be crude, self-evidently, regardless of one's social ethics on sexuality, human beings are supposed to reproduce in opposite sex couples. We believe as a society that we think same-sex couples should have the right to bear children, and that's clearly been possible via adoption for a while. You know, increasingly same-sex couples do it through donor eggs or donor sperm, depending on if it's lesbian or gay couple. But we're basically saying we are dissatisfied with the limitations that say, you know, only one of those parents will have a genetic tie. And so we are now pushing forward the boundary to say, why shouldn't two men or two women literally biologically conceive a child that is bone of their bones and flesh of their flesh? We're kind of basically dissatisfied with the boundaries that biology gives us.
Yeah. And I think this is a characteristic of, it really starts with the Enlightenment, this sense of autonomos, I make my own rules, autonomy, and therefore, and the natural order is seen as a kind of restriction, which is constantly getting in the way. And freedom is freedom from the restrictions that the natural order creates. I'm free. I shouldn't be hidebound by all these pettifogging restrictions. Who says? Why not? Yeah. And I think that fundamental desire really burst out under the Enlightenment and has gone ever since. And of course, it's not all bad. It's because of that desire for scientific research to push, you know, the what if, you know, that has led to so many breakthroughs and advances, technical advances. But it always has this kind of, I mean, to use a word, Promethean. Prometheus was stealing fire from the gods, and this Promethean desire to extend is very powerful.
I mean, you could even say, if you wanted to theologize it, it is an aspect of our desire to become God, to have the power over created order that God himself has. You know, we see God, it's no difficulty for God to kind of rupture the created order of things. He did that when, you know, Jesus was born of a virgin. That's clearly not how children are supposed to be born. And God, being the creator, has the ability and the right to contradict his own kind of typical, the tram lines in which life normally works. And I think human beings fundamentally wish to have the same power. We wish to be, you know, as Adam and Eve in the garden, knowing good and evil, just like God is.
Yeah, and there is a deep theological debate here, which, you know, I think it's important to recognize. So if we try to think from, you know, what are Christian responses? I think it would be true to say that the dominant and orthodox Christian position has been that we are always called to be free within the natural order. The natural order is a given. And yes, God gives us enormous freedom, an enormous level of choice, but it's not the same as autonomy. Freedom and autonomy are not the same thing. Christian freedom is freedom within constraints, within rules, and autonomy is I make my own rules. I decide. I think I would broadly support that position. And a nice example, which is often used, is jazz improvisation. A really skilled jazz musician has an enormous amount of freedom. They know their instrument incredibly well. They can do whatever they like with it. And they also have a very deep understanding of harmony and progressions and all the rest. And a really skilled improviser is both free and constrained at the same time. They have an enormous amount of freedom as to how they express themselves, but they are constrained by the fundamental rules of music harmony. And there was a period in jazz where it was called free jazz, where there were literally no rules, and everybody just picked up their saxophone or whatever, and they just blew whatever they liked. And it's complete cacophony. And surprise, surprise, it didn't really catch on.
People don't want to pay to come and listen to that.
So I think it is quite a nice analogy of how freedom and order can actually coexist. But there is more recently, there's a new theological view, actually an ancient theological view, which is being rediscovered, which says, actually, God has given us, part of the creation mandates, part of his creating human beings in his own image, is that ultimately, when we become of age, he will allow us to participate. And this is sometimes called co-creation. We've become co-creators with God. We together with him, collaborate now in the work of changing, advancing, manipulating the creation.
Interesting. I mean, it all comes back to, well, it doesn't all, part of it comes back to how you understand those early chapters of Genesis and the kind of mandate given to human beings there to have dominion over, which, you know, is often talked about as like, oh, it's about stewardship. But that's not quite what Genesis says. It's a bit stronger than that. It says you to rule over, you know, I give you this clearly mankind is set as not as this kind of like, you know, gentle gardener, but you are to have dominion. Yeah. Dominion over the garden. You can name them. You can rule over them. You are a sub king, delegated authority from the actual creator king. And how you understand what that means is obviously muchly up for debate.
Absolutely. But just look at what human beings have done to this planet. The planet is unrecognizable from what it was even 500 years ago. You know, that's why they call it the Anthropocene. You know, we are one species is actually having geologically significant.
We're terraforming the entire climate.
We're terraforming, exactly right. Yeah. And then the question comes, well, okay, is this all complete hubris? There are some Christians arguing that this is just, you know, this is madness, and we've got to somehow retrieve a previous existence. But I think most of us would say, you know, there's such a lot of this, we can see God's hand at work. And of course, healthcare is a classic example, but agriculture, the fact that we can feed people, the fact that most of us actually across the planet are able to live in moderate levels of comfort and freedom and security. Is this all just hubris, or was this part of God's intention for humankind?
I mean, I think we often struggle to understand just how much everything that we think of, you know, because I think agriculture is an interesting example. A lot of people say, you know, oh, you know, this is all about the green revolution in the 1950s and 60s that radically increased kind of seed potentials and later genetically modification. But actually, wheat itself, the very concept of wheat, is not a naturally occurring plant. It only exists in the form that is like productive to farm and harvest because humans 10,000 years ago, over many generations, selectively bred it to make it, you know, naturally occurring wheat is gritty, awful, useless stuff. And it was only when humans repeatedly messed around, as we now understand, with the DNA of the wheat through a kind of artificial version of natural selection, turned it into a useful crop. And then as we grew agriculture, suddenly that's what turned humans from scattered nomadic hunter-gatherers into settled communities that created surplus to create, you know, specialization and then language and writing and like all of human civilization. Long before like this biblical era of the Old Testament, you know, 10,000 years before that, was only possible because humans didn't just accept the world as it was, but actively, without fully understanding, got their fingers into the DNA of God's created order and said, we are going to radically transform the raw materials God has given us and build something completely new with it.
Yes, and Christians have always been very fundamentally at the heart of that. You know, you can trace all the way back to the medieval period. Again, this simple caricature that you've got sort of brave scientists sort of doing innovative things. You've got all those terrible Christians being completely, you know, on the side of the resistance and so on. It's just not true. The monasteries were great sites of invention and many different areas. Yes, this is a very long theme, but the real question is where are the limits? And are there limits? And one place to put the limits is to say that we have been free to transform the rest of creation, but we're not free to transform our own nature. That there is some kind of shining boundary when it comes to human nature and therefore the human body in terms of deliberately choosing to transform it. And so, I mean, just a sort of simple example. You look at dogs today, and you know, the extraordinary thing about dogs is they're all genetically identical, virtually identical. So every single dog is thought to be descended from a pair species of wolves who seem to be remarkably tolerant of human beings and able to understand and work alongside. But what's happened in the is that human beings have said, you know, could we make a really big dog, or could we make a really tiny dog, or could we make a one with very funny nose, or could we make one with huge great ears? And so selective breeding has been going on for literally thousands of years, and we now have everything from, you know, the massive great Dane, you know, to poodles and rat-like little things. And the same could have happened with human beings. I mean, we could have selectively bred human beings. We could have had giants and tiny pygmies and all the rest. But we don't. We've basically been a mongrel race. And what you see are mongrel humans. And we haven't gone for selective breeding. Are we now able to take control of the human constitution and change it?
And we've discussed this in previous episodes about, you know, genetic editing of embryos, and to what extent is that, if you're trying to fix so-called genetic faults that cause diseases, if we can dive into the genetic code of a few day old embryo and tweak it so it doesn't develop that life-limiting condition, would that be a win, even if it is messing around with the structure of what makes us humans? Is that just kind of preventative healthcare, or is that playing God? And but then obviously that once people can mess around with their children, they will obviously not restrict themselves to curing disease, but they will say, wouldn't it be nice to have a tall son? Wouldn't it be nice to have an incredibly intelligent daughter? Let's make sure they're not ginger. Let's make sure they're predisposed to be athletic or whatever else. And there are already, as we've discussed, companies that claim to be offering these kind of services in less regulated parts of the world.
So one of the frameworks I found extraordinarily helpful thinking about this is the difference between transforming parenthood and accepting parenthood. And the point is that all parenthood involves both stances. So we both accept our children as they are. That's one of the very painful realities of all parenting. As much
particularly
as
for you,
wish,
eh, Dad?
Yeah, particularly for me. Much as you would wish your children to turn out in particular ways. Now, they have their own characteristics, their own desires, their own choices. And as a large amount of parenthood is acceptance, accepting that my child is different from me, and giving them freedom to become the person they were meant to be. But at the same time, we don't just accept them as they are. We also attempt to transform them. And therefore, just the whole process of socialization and teaching them manners and teaching them how to behave and how to be polite and everything else. That whole process of education is about transformation. And so the argument goes that there ought to be a balance between acceptance and transformation. But modern parenthood, within the zeitgeist of the Enlightenment, have majored on transformation. Transformation now becomes the dominant activity. And actually, having moved here to Oxford recently, one of the things you see are large numbers of pushy parents whose entire life exists around their little darlings, who they are desperately trying to coach and to become the world's latest genius. And it's almost as though the parents are living out their desires by transforming their children. So I just to bring that to land, so I think that reproductive technology can very easily move into this transforming, controlling stance rather than the accepting, loving stance.
The other thing that came to mind reading this story, and I've been on been on this bandwagon before in the podcast, and I have a particular perspective as an adoptive parent, but it's just this kind of the obsession with DNA, the obsession with a genetic inheritance and a genetic link to your children. You know, the amount of money and scientific effort that has been spent, and at the end of it, what is gained that couldn't have been done before? You know, there's nothing to prevent a same-sex couple right now from using donor sperm or donor egg, conceiving a child that is 50% related to them. But that is clearly insufficient, even though that child will from birth know both parents as their mothers or their fathers and will grow up happy and loved. And that child won't really know or care that its DNA is only 50% connected. And yet that's not sufficient for us because we are so laser focused on this idea. Like once we unlocked the secret of our inheritance and how that works, it feels like we've kind of geneticized our framework of how we view the world. We see everything through DNA glasses. And it just feels to me slightly bizarre that this has become so important to people to have that genetic link. Again, and the same goes for people experiencing infertility. I'd never want to be glib about that. It's a really painful place to find yourself in. And I understand why people yearn for children. But again, DNA is not the be-all and end-all. A child can be truly your child and not share any of your DNA. I know that because my daughter has no DNA from me, and it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, and I'm with you. I think we probably ought to be turned to our second subject, but just to make the comment that, of course, you're right that since the invention of DNA, people have laser focused on this, but actually it's not new. I mean, the whole thing about, you know, children born out of wedlock and actually I am really the son of XYZ, you know, you may think I'm a nobody, but really. So, you know, the whole thing about inheritance, who you really are, identity, it isn't just DNA. It's a very deep-rooted thing in the human condition.
No, it is. And very briefly, it is. The flip side of that is what we also know is that people do care about this. And that is why I would always be extremely cautious about people kind of creating children that have three parents or four parents through these various techniques that we've worked out in the last 50 years. Because even if it doesn't matter at all, children definitely still experience a bond with the surrogate who carried them or the stranger who donated the sperm or the stranger who donated the ovum that the nucleus was that, you know, whatever it is, people will feel a tie with these people and that it can be challenging for children to grow up with, you know, more than the two parents they were supposed to have.
Have you ever wrestled with tough questions about faith? Or maybe you've had a friend who's skeptical about Christianity? That's exactly why we want to send you a powerful resource that I believe needs to be in the hands of every believer. Justin Brierley's book, Unbelievable, Why, After 10 Years of Talking with Atheists, I'm Still a Christian. In this book, Justin reflects on 10 years of conversations with atheists, skeptics, and believers alike, and explains why he still finds Christianity the most compelling explanation for life, the universe, and everything in between. I know this book will strengthen your faith and equip you for meaningful conversations. And for a limited time, this book is our special thanks to you for your gift to Premier Insight. Your support ensures content like this and other shows and programs are available to bring faith-filled conversations to a world that needs them. So I encourage you to give today by going to premierinsight.org/C.S. Lewis. That's premierinsight.org/C.S. Lewis to receive your book today. Now on to today's show.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
But on that note, shall we move on? We talked a bit longer than that we thought we would. The question, it's a completely different topic, so we're going to do a bit of a gear change here, but it's a question from a listener called Ali. And Ali was responding to our episode a month or so ago. We did a talked about miraculous kind of faith healing and talked around some of the theology of that and how it intersects in kind of modern church life, particularly for those who have a medical background. And Ali wrote in saying this, as someone who's recently joined a Vineyard church, healing is something that's often emphasized along with John Wimber. He's the American pastor who I think founded the Vineyard movement. John Wimber's phrase of quote, doing the stuff. A verse that's often mentioned is from John 14, which is where Jesus says, very truly, I tell you, whoever believes in me will do the works I've been doing and they will do even greater things than these. And Ali goes on to say, do you think the greater things Jesus mentioned were meant to include miraculous healings? And if so, how should we understand that promise today? many Christians who believe in modern day healing prayer use that verse as a basis for expecting God to still act powerfully.
Yeah, so it's a really interesting question. And I'm that verse, I'm well aware, has been constantly used over the years and constantly quoted, really to do with all supernatural and charismatic activities, but particularly to do with healing. And I must say, I think most Bible scholars would find it hard to support that the idea that that verse meant that we as followers of Jesus were designed to do more spectacular, more extraordinary miracles compared with Jesus. I mean, it may be worth, if you didn't listen to that previous episode, could I gently suggest you do, because in a way we can't rehearse it all. The idea being that there was something special about Jesus' miracles. They weren't just, you know, spectacular wonder-working things. They were semeia, they were signs in the Greek. They were signposts that here was someone extraordinary and different. And the reality, as we have discussed in the last episode, was that the miracles, the healing, so-called miracles and signs, which are attested to today, seem to be in a different category from the miracles that are recorded in the Gospels that Jesus undertook. And I think that that is pretty undeniable. I think, you know, if you were to push back and challenge and say, okay, well, how many people do you know that have been risen from the dead? That are actually pointed to, because the whole point about the resurrection was that it was witnessed. There were hundreds of people who saw Jesus alive. You know, well, could you find another witnessed resurrection from the dead in the recent era? Could you find well-documented cases of people who were born blind without eyes and who subsequently developed eyes and so on and so on? And I think it's hard to really make that claim. So what does that verse mean? And I think people have suggested it means other things, that extraordinary things that Christians have done, works that they've done, not in the sense of signs, extraordinary, unexpected signs, but, you know, if one was just to take the fact that Christian teachers have spoken to literally millions of people at the same time across the world through technology, that the gospel has been preached to over a billion people across the planet. You know, that over the centuries, what the church has done, what are the acts and deeds of the church? You know, at the moment, there's a lot of interest in the way that the Christian faith and the Christian church has been at the foundation of so much of Western civilization. I mean, doesn't it make more sense that these are the greater things that the followers of Christ have done rather than particularly spectacular supernatural miracles?
Hmm. And I think it's always worth, when we're talking about Bible verses, to not try and snip them out of their context, but actually think about where they come in the flow of that bit of John's gospel. So the broader passage is about Jesus comforting his disciples. You know, he talks about, you know, I'm going to the Father to prepare a place for you. I'm going to come back and take you. Lord, we don't know where you're going. How can we know the way? And Jesus says, I'm the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father. If you really know me, you'll know the Father. And Philip says, just show us the Father and that'll be enough. Jesus says, don't you know me, Philip? Anyone who's seen me has seen the Father. Don't you believe that I am in the Father and the Father's in me? The words I say to you, I do not speak on my own authority. It's the Father living in me. Believe me when I say that I am in the Father and the Father is in me, or at least believe on the evidence of the works themselves. Very truly, I tell you, whoever believes in me will do the works I've been doing, and they will do an even greater things than these, because I'm going to the Father. So I guess what I would take from that is, you know, the works, clearly that is referring to, in part, to Jesus's ministry, his he kind of makes a distinction between the message he's speaking and the works of his hands. But it's fundamentally about the great thing that, or at least the thrust of this part of the conversation is Jesus saying that it's about demonstrating who God is through his words and through his deeds. And that is, he's going to the Father, but the whole point is he's going to send his Holy Spirit so that his disciples will continue that task. The Father will be in them through the Spirit, and they will speak and act in the name of the Father to an unbelieving world to continue this evangelistic commission that Jesus has launched in his own ministry. And that doesn't exclude miracles. Neither of us would be cessationists and say that, you know, miracles are impossible today and they ended when Jesus ascended to heaven. I won't speak for you. I certainly am not a cessationist.
Yeah,
I think the thrust of the passage seems to be around to what extent are the disciples called to take up this mission, this ministry of demonstrating who God is through their works, through their words.
Absolutely. And I would just want to add, it's wider than evangelism, which is often narrowly construed as explaining how someone can become a Christian. The works are every way in which Jesus is good news for the world. And that includes, you know, the fact that Christians have been pioneers of healthcare, of social action and care, of justice systems, of reconciliation, and so on. So these are the works, it seems to me, that God has done through the church, through his believers, and which he continues to do. And they continue to impact the whole of the world. By God's grace, they will continue to do that right to the end of the age. But the reason as a medic why I worry about the claims of spectacular miracles is that it puts a huge amount of inadvertent pressure on Christians, that I haven't got enough faith. I'm the failure. Someone else has got healed, but I haven't got healed. And that must be because I didn't manage to have faith as a mustard seed. And, you know, God is longing to heal me if only I can have the faith. And I'm afraid I've seen the damage that's done and how people who feel they haven't been healed are locked out of going for Christian care because I'm a failure and God clearly doesn't love me because he's failed to heal me.
Yeah. And I think where I would be very hesitant is when people use verses like this greater things to say, this is automatic, this is straightforward. All you have to do is be a Christian, and Jesus says you will do greater things. What did Jesus do? He raised people from the dead. So we're going to have to do even greater things than that. You know, Jesus healed people, even greater things than that. There is mystery here. Like, I don't have any time for a theology of healing that doesn't grapple with the basic fact that most people's experience is that most of the time when they ask God for miraculous healing, God chooses in his mysterious wisdom that we can't fathom not to respond miraculously. That's my experience. I think that's probably your experience. I think that's true, I think, of most Christians throughout time, is that most of the time we ask in his name for healing, and most of the time someone is not healed. And if our theology can't grapple with that basic fact, except by, as you say, effectively damning the person who asked or the person who is receiving as being deficient in some way, I'm not interested in it. There has to be space for the mystery of God here. And I mean, the very next verse is, and I will do whatever you ask in my name so that the Father may be glorified in the Son. You may ask me for anything in my name and I will do it. And yet we all know that God's not a slot machine. You can't just make an incantation in the name of Jesus, make me a millionaire. And it doesn't happen like that. Obviously, there is mystery here. We have to work a lot harder to understand what Jesus is saying and what it means for us as disciples today. it's not a, you know, input here, output there. That's not how prayer, that's not how our God works. And we need to have a theology of miraculous healing that has space for the miraculous. I 100% believe that God does still miraculously heal today sometimes. We have to have space for that. We have to yearn for it. We're instructed to pray for it in elsewhere in the New Testament. But we can't have a simplistic, naive theology of healing that says it's something that is easy or comes automatically or is somehow within our control or our power.
That's absolutely right. And one thing I have noticed is it a key question for those who want to reemphasize miraculous healing is, what do you make of the Gethsemane prayer? What do you make of the prayer where Jesus says, nevertheless, not what I will, but what you want? That, and for what it's worth, my perspective is that that is the ultimate prayer. That is the heart of what it means to follow Jesus, and that actually we spend the whole time, the whole of our lives, going into the mystery of that prayer. Nevertheless, not what I want, but what you want. But I have heard charismatic Christians say, but that prayer's a cop-out. You know, you've got to have faith. You've got to claim the victory, you know. And that's, I just have to diverge from that. I'm sorry, you know, if you're saying that Jesus' prayer is a cop-out, you know, I can't go with you there. That I see as the ultimate prayer that comes before everything else.
Yeah. If Christ himself could submit his will and his desires when he actually did have the power, as he demonstrated, to do what he wanted, you know, he could have called down legions upon angels to take him off that cross, to waltz through the arms of the soldiers, come to arrest him in the garden. If he can submit his will and desires into the hands of his Father God and say, I trust in your plans, I trust in your way, I trust that you are in control and I am not, how much more so, I think, are we as fallen, created, human, solely human disciples and followers called to say, it's not how I might do it, but I'm going to trust that you've got a bigger picture and a better plan.
Absolutely. And of course, you know, if I've got some terrible illness, I can pray, Lord, I want to be healed. And if my spouse has got a terrible illness, I can say, Lord, I want my wife to be healed. And if my child has got a desperate illness, I'll say even more, Lord, please heal her. But nevertheless, not my will, but your will be done.
Yeah. And it's never a complete answer because we can't wrap our heads around how could it be God's will for this loved one of mine not to be made well. We can't understand that. We have no answer to that question. And we're left somewhat like Job saying, I don't know the answer. I don't know why suffering happens. I don't know why God doesn't get rid of it. But we need to understand our place in the ecosystem here and understand that he is the one who, you know, set the stars in motion and made the mountains and all the other stuff that God says at the end of Job, and we are not. And we need to have an appropriate humility as we reflect on these things. It's where I would end anyway. Okay. Thanks so much, Ali, for that really thought-provoking, helpful question. Flesh out a few more things. We'd love to receive questions from listeners, particularly if you disagree or want to kind of challenge us on something we've said on this podcast. Please do get in touch, or to suggest kind of news stories or scientific developments or interesting shifts in culture that you'd like us to respond to. We really, really appreciate that. You can get in touch with us by email. You can email molad@premier.org.uk. And as always, do go to Dad's website, johnwyatt.com, for lots more resources, particularly on kind of bioethics and medical moral issues. And from my website, if you're interested in church news, tswyatt.com, you can find some links. In particular, I would point you towards my weekly Substack newsletter, The Critical Friend, which you can sign up to for free. That's it. Thanks for listening, everyone. We'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, bye-bye.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
cozy traditions feel good, especially this time of year. And that includes your fall makeup look. From lashes for days with liquid lash extension mascara to enhancing a smoky eye with your favorite shade of Brilliant Eye Brightener, Thrive Cosmetics is your go-to for completing every fall look. Whether you want a simple, just gotta get out the door routine or fall glam that wows at all your favorite festivities, you'll always look and feel radiant with Thrive Cosmetics. Plus, every product is vegan, cruelty-free, and made with clean, skin-loving ingredients. Complete your fall look. Go to thrivecosmetics.com/cozy for an exclusive offer of 20% off your first order. That's Thrive Cosmetics, CAUSEMETICS.com/cozy.